But everything's looking good. All my levels are clear, and we're here.
If your levels are clear, then no one's hearing you at all.
I mean, my levels are not above... I don't know the term.
It's below below sea level, below Nick level. I don't know.
Below... What is the actual term when it like decibels. Goes too high and it?
Oh, it's called not peaking.
Blowout.
What is that called?
Isn't that called a blowout? Like, wasn't that the whole thing with John Travolta in that one sound movie where he like cut like when you yell too loud it like blows it out or something?
No, it's called a blowout. Blowout in that movie and it referred to an actual sound of a tire burnt blowing out and that he caught. On recording, I think.
Oh, that's right.
Such a good
that's
old right. movie.
I thought that was just a coincidence. I thought that was an actual term.
It's actually called...
Because you can blow out your speakers, right? Like, isn't that the whole thing?
Sean, what is it called? He's in the room. I got a resident audio expert. Sean.
Hey, Sean.
What's it called when audio levels max out? There's a name for it. It's called not peaking. It's something ing.
sexual peaking.
Redlining, he says.
Red dawning.
Red dawning.
Russians hack it.
In the interest of flick of the week, it's red dawning.
Wolverine.
All right. Is that how we're starting the show, or are you going to ask me an inappropriate question?
Okay, yeah, I was going to hope to ask you an inappropriate question.
Let's get to the inappropriate question, why don't we? All
right, I like how we finally hit the little streak now. Now we're, after, even during the quarantine, it's allowed us to kind of get set in our ways.
Definitely.
So, just want to say I appreciate you.
Oh.
I can't quit you, Jordan.
Forrest. Forrest. You don't know what podcasting
that
is.
That wasn't Forrest. That was Brokeback Mountain.
Oh.
That's why I thought you were all awkward, but you didn't even know.
Oh, my God. That's funny. I do like that movie, too. I just haven't seen it in a while. I guess I forgot that line.
It's like the one line Jake Gyllenhaal is like known for that movie.
Dang it, Jordan.
Anyway, okay.
Inappropriate question.
On average... Mm-hmm. Because you're a gym rat of sorts,
mm-hmm.
and you went to the same high school I did. So in your entire time of men's locker rooms, how many nude males would you say you've caught a glance of, give or take?
In high school, maybe one.
No, all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was going to clarify, though. I feel like... High school.
We're not going to segregate
the
nudity.
But at gyms, dude, it's always 70-year-old men. And there's got to be like 40-plus occasions in my life. And I'm just like, I didn't need to see those old balls.
I don't even go unless I have to pee. I just go shower at home. I'm like, my car can be sweaty. I don't care.
Yeah,
this is not fun.
Very rarely do I bring a gym bag. I just bring... what I'm wearing to the gym and then maybe a water bottle, you know?
That's it.
Yeah. I don't see the point. I mean, I guess there are some people that like to, you know, tether their gym time into a commute or something. And then also there's some old men that just like to walk around with, you know, swinging dick, but, you know, to each his own.
I know. I wonder if it's because like they've reached an age where like they thought, you know, there's no kids living here. I still can't be naked in my own house. And so they just go to the gym.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
that was not as climactic as I thought it would be. Let's start the show.
Wait, let me explain something to you. I'm the dude.
What is it?
It's the one that said bad motherfucker.
Who throws a shoe? Honestly.
The first rule of Fight Club is... you do not talk about Fight Club.
We're sending you back to the future!
All right, welcome back to a consistent episode of Flick of the Week. I'm your host, Nick Drake.
And I'm Jordan O'More. And he already said his flick of the week, so fuck it.
That's right. Redundancy but it's, is what we're about.
This show, we're not, we're maximalists on this show.
That's right.
Here's what we're going to do. Today, Jordan's taking the wheel. Not Jesus. Jordan.
Jordan, take the wheel.
And I want to go into the vault, and you'll realize...
That the Disney vault?
The Disney vault. No, you'll realize that I'm making a pun when I say that, because I watched an old movie that I had not seen that I really enjoyed. Do you want to take a crack at it since I said vault?
Dog Day Afternoon?
No, that's a good one, though. Similar era. I watched The Great Train Robbery with Sean Connery. Oh, right on.
Seanery Connery.
And I have a lot of opinions about this. I really, really liked it, by the way.
Was Donald Sutherland in that
yes,
one, too?
Yeah, Donald yeah. Sutherland. And it was written and directed by Michael Crichton.
Is that true?
That is true.
Of all people, right? Jurassic Park, Michael Crichton?
Yes.
Wow.
And he wrote the novel and the screenplay, and he directed it. This is like his magnum opus.
Really?
Yes.
The Great Train Robbery?
Yeah. And that's why it got me thinking. And I got a couple of things to say. I'm really impressed by it's like one of the strongest written movies I've watched in a long time, especially an older movie. Well, I mean, I guess that's the opposite is true. Like newer movies are weak in a lot of ways, but
weak.
But no, I very much respected that it was really, it had an incredibly tight story and it was really freaking hilarious in clever ways, cleverly hilarious. And then also, they didn't pay you, the audience, any favors by trying to make Victorian era England modernized for, like, especially the way they speak. Like, everyone's talking the way they would have talked back then. And so you get what they're saying, but you don't at the same time. You're kind of like, the fuck did he just say?
I know. And it's so weird because, like, if Seanery Jenner Connery did, like, another movie where they're, like, in... It's called, like, In the Name of the Rose. And I think they're, like, in Afghanistan or something. And for some reason, there's some Irish guy there. It's, like, the complete, like, Hollywood. He's done both, like, versions of what you're talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know he made Westworld?
Yes.
The original?
Yeah. So, Michael what Crichton's career, writer. Yeah, he's... I mean, I was... Until I saw and heard about The Great Train Robbery, I mean, I'd known about the movie, but I didn't know it had anything to do with Michael Crichton. I was under the impression that Crichton only knows how to make Disneyland gone wrong. Like, he's good at it. I guess if you're good at something, keep doing it. Never do it for free. I think that when I was watching this, it was just like seeing Bullet. You know, if you watch Bullet, as an adult, I guess, and as a movie fan, you know what I'm talking about?
Steve McQueen's Bullet. Mickey Rourke?
Steve McQueen.
Okay, thank God.
No, if you watch that movie, you catch glimpses of the fact that it was the original cop, like gritty cop movie. Like it laid the tracks for future movies to come.
Dude, plus they do like the thing everyone's always wanted to do in San Francisco with those roads.
Yes.
Just like fly off of them.
And well, it just, like I said, think about all of the movies that came after that it mm-hmm. in a sense emulated what happened in Bullet. And they came up with better ways to do it, obviously, because technology got better and expectations got higher. But The Great Train Robbery, I think, serves as one of the early like inspirations for some of the greater modern heist films. You know what I'm saying? Especially to draw the correlation. I know there was Ocean's 11 was a remake of the original Ocean's 11, but I think that Ocean's 11, the remake with George Clooney, definitely borrowed tons of pages out of the Great Train Robbery to make their to tell their story the way they told it. It's really, really fascinating. And then also, I know you, outside of the show, you'd asked if I would be interested in taking a part of time in these episodes to talk about some kind of film technique.
Yeah, because I think that whenever you have some sort of platform, whether it's popular or not, it's the way that you present value. And we could talk about movies all day, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, definitely appreciative and grateful that we have something like this. But I think that's the benefit would be so much more if we could bring something like that in, even just on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
Because we have you, and you know, I'm just basically an encyclopedia for movies. I know a bit about writing, but as far as technical stuff for how things are filmed, you know, I could speculate, but it's coming from the horse's mouth if we have you kind of go into it.
Yeah, well, I in terms of this movie, the big thing that caught my eye when I was watching it is I was really impressed by the writing, really impressed by the acting and the set design and production design. So like you really feel like you're considering it was made in 1978. They really went to town on accuracies. It was in the realm of Barry Lyndon, how it was like, this is accurate, you know? But what it seemed like it lacked was any technological prowess when it came to like being a cinematic marvel. It just seemed like it was shot, which as I was getting through it, I realized that it was intentional. Because it seemed like it was like a made-for-TV kind of shot, just basic in basic masters, pretty standard shooting. There was nothing flashy about it, nothing that made me say like, "Oh, that was a beautiful shot." But one of the things that I realized that they were trying to emulate was old Victorian era photography, which of the time they didn't have any eye for symmetry or things like that. So symmetry was out the window, but also the biggest technique that I had found was a technique called I should have wrote it down here. I got a page open about it. It's called net diffusion. And I originally, as I was watching the movie, I'm like, all these shots seem so fuzzy, so blurry. But really what it is what they're doing is that it's an old-fashioned trick where you take a pair of pantyhose and you stretch it around the back of a lens and pinch it into the camera, and light hitting the net of the pantyhose like diffuses and makes all of the highlights really soft and cloudy. And it's an intentional look to look like a you know, an old tintype photo.
Yeah, see, I thought that was just like what 50s, 60s film just looked like. And I think this was made in the 80s.
This is 1979.
79, yeah. So close.
And it's, it's very intentional. But I think that it became something that just people don't do anymore. Because it like, the intention is there, but the result isn't, it seems muddy, you know? Like the other movie that I can think of off the top of my head that is relevant that does that same thing is it called On Golden Pond, or you know what I'm talking about?
That's a film. I don't know what you mean by that though.
Let me see. Let me make sure. On Golden Pond, it is called On Golden Pond. Yeah. It was made in 1981, similar era, but it's starring Katherine Hepburn and Henry Fonda, and they're old people, and they just wanted to make like these older people look good on camera, and they employed the same effect for a different reason, to like soften skin tones.
I wonder if they did that for Cocoon.
They probably did, but it like you said, you're like, it just looks muddy. I thought that was what old film looked like. No, it's just a technique that they're trying to soften skin tones, but in turn you soften everything.
Okay.
But I think, you know, this is a cautionary tale to like look at and realize that when you are shooting things, so if there are people out there listening that are interested in shooting things, I think that this effect is a great effect to use in camera as for dream sequences, or if someone has lost their glasses, or things that like where you want to have an intentional in focus image but still blurry at the same time. It's like fuzzy, you know.
I think you could do that with like a DSLR.
Definitely, yeah. You can take any pair of pantyhose or any kind of net material that's thin enough, and you stretch it over the back of the lens and stick it into the camera and lock it, and there you go. I've done this many
times.
Imagine
a YouTube channel dedicated to all their videos looking like that.
That would be weird, yeah. It's like, clean the Vaseline off your lens there, bud.
Like, okay, this is a video of my grandpa, but, you know, it's not in 60s film. It's just pantyhose. I just wanted you to get the point that this man is old.
So what I wanted to, I mean, and then the Vaseline on a lens is also another technique, by the way.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
That's what they did for Benny and June.
Yep.
That Johnny Depp movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are all sorts of techniques. But back to the Great Train Robbery. I was really fascinated. I think this is the first occurrence I've ever seen of a movie where you have every character, it's an ensemble movie, and every character is a narrator of the movie, depending on their certain expertise, like of the crime, the heist. So like when it's their time to shine, you hear them as the narrator. I was like, ah, this is totally fucking Ocean's 11. No, wait, Ocean's 11 is totally copying this. You know what I'm saying?
I think that it's, you know, a version of it where it works. It's definitely not the first time that's been done, but this is like probably the first movie in either a very long time at the time. And it seems like there really hasn't been too many since that has been just such a smart film. Like it really makes you turn on your thinking cap and like be technical with things that are just movie magic, essentially. I just remember reading that, like, because he was James Bond, you know, but they had Sean Connery like running on trains.
Yep.
And like he thought they were going like slow, but like they were actually going like 50 miles an hour.
That's the part that was baffling me when I was watching it. I mean, I'm wondering about the section of IMDb. I didn't read into it much, but that, like, from a technical standpoint, when I was watching that, the scene of the train, the actual train robbery, when he's up on top of the train, I'm like looking and trying to just like dissect how they did it. And I'm thinking,
no wires.
There's no wires. And it's not like in Indiana Jones where you really do have Harrison Ford on the ground being dragged by the truck, but he's only going like 5 miles an hour and they just speed it up. It's not that. They're not moving a train really slowly and speeding it up. It's really going fast. And then the bridges are really there and they're flying by. It's like, that's...
Well, not only that, but like the shit that billows out the locomotive, like that's actually like fire. And so like I think like I heard something like Michael Crichton's hair caught on fire and Sean Connery's like eyes were getting all jacked up.
Oh my God.
Like stuff that, you know, people would like definitely get sued over and this and that these days.
Yeah.
Back then it was like, you're going to get some soot in your eyes. Well, we need the shot.
It's interesting. I'm assuming they shot in, what were the shooting locations? I'm assuming they shot in England, right? Let's see.
Maybe. It was like the thing England, with trains. Yeah, it's like you have to shoot where actual freaking trains are. You can't move a train.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and there's no green screen. And well, they did have like the moving picture, but that definitely wasn't it. And so like the cool thing with like any movie with a train is like, oh, this is actually there. Mm-hmm. It's not pretending to be somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, the rules and it was definitely in effect back then. Excuse me. The England Film Commission or the film unions of England are like super strict, and especially back then. So it makes me wonder how they got away with it. Almost like must have been made in a very like run and gun guerrilla style, you know, way.
Maybe because if Michael Crichton, it was really just I think it was like his third or fourth movie.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think the other ones were all like, I'm thinking like Coma with Michael Douglas, wasn't it? And it was like the whole movie's in a hospital. Mm-hmm. So it probably was like his first, you know, legit like location movie. And he was probably like, fuck, I don't know. I haven't done this before. Let's just do it this way.
Yeah. I mean, I can watching it and knowing what era it was shot in, it makes me think like it could easily have gone super south. They could have, you know, just had a top of a fake train car and a big projection screen, and they had people on the sides rattling the sides of the car, and it's clearly inside, you know.
I think like Unforgiven, where it shows Dumbledore like shooting birds and stuff. Like there's a scene where like the train goes by and that's clearly like a real train.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like close-ups of him shooting guns. It was like clearly just something, a background behind him, you know. Not this movie though. Mm-hmm. This movie they're like, James Bond, you're James Bond. Like, get on the train.
I also think that looking at this movie, I was like, this is why, I can tell that this is why he was cast as Indiana Jones's dad. Because this makes me feel like that's fucking Indiana Jones's dad right there. You know, he robbed the train because he wanted the money. He didn't need it. He just wanted to prove that he could do it. That's fucking great.
Did I ever tell you my Donald Sutherland story?
No. Let's hear it.
So my mom used to work for American Express. And I guess like Kiefer Sutherland lost his card. And so Donald Sutherland like called in. And I guess she wasn't like taking any crap from him, and she couldn't do anything because he's not the card holder, you know. So he's like, "Do you know who I am?" And like, it got to the point where she like just hung up on him.
Oh my god!
And then she like stood up, you know, if you can imagine, like cubicles. Like, does anybody know Donald Sutherland? And everybody's like, "Oh, what the fuck!"
Oh my god, that's hilarious.
Well, but then I wonder if like Kiefer Sutherland was like running up his dad's cards,
right? But I mean, in all fairness, they're just because they're notable doesn't give them any extra rights with a bank, you know? I don't think.
No, I think that's like the whole thing. Why Nicolas Cage does so many shitty movies? Like, there's been videos of him like pawning his belongings because like some people are just spenders.
Yeah. Wow.
That was before 24, so I don't know.
Oh, really? Wow.
He didn't have that Fox money yet.
Gotta have that Fox money. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that I was incredibly inspired by this movie. It was really interesting to see. And then also, like I said, it just got me thinking about, because the next day, so I watched that, not last night, but the night prior.
Is this on Netflix or something right now?
It's on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Amazon.
I haven't seen it in so long. I'll probably watch it again.
Yeah. It's a good watch. But the next day after watching that, I watched The Aeronauts, which just came out. But it's the same era. It's like Victorian era England. But it's as clear as day that The Aeronauts, which was made for modern audiences. They you know, everyone is speaking in the British accent, but they're like, they're saying things that are kind of modern colloquialisms of the day.
LOL, LOL.
Yeah, they're saying ruffle.
T-T-Y-O. Toots my goats.
Toots my goats. But that's, I was just like rolling my eyes. Like, it's night and day difference that you have to have mad respect for Michael Crichton for doing all this research and writing like beautiful dialogue.
Well, and the thing is like, he was, I think he wrote the book. Isn't that so cool? Like, he was like a writer that just took charge of like everything. Mm-hmm. He like maxed out his full potential. He was just like a novelist and then a, you know, screenplay writer and then director.
Yeah.
And sometimes all three, like in this case. Yeah. And he like wrote that book based off of like a real 1800s train robbery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's the person that's talented enough to craft, you know, an endearing story around it.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's why I was saying in the beginning of this, I think that this is kind of his magnum opus. Because he's wrote maybe a book, and then he wrote the screenplay, and he got to direct it. And it's like, this, it's an epic movie. Like, even by today's standards, it's pretty insane.
You know what's weird is, like, I heard that people still haven't maximized his potential for Jurassic Park yet. And there's like five films. Like, somebody, I've never read the book, but somebody told me, like, there's a part where the velociraptors basically learn how to become invisible and stuff like that.
What?
So they evolve past like what humans could handle. Like, that was really like the big problem. And so the movies just keep like, you know, picking and choosing things, and it's really like, if this died down for like another 10 or 20 years, I feel like it could have a good reboot if it was like straight off the source material.
Oh, speaking of, that was a great transition. I watched Jay and Silent Bob Reboot the other day.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
And I really liked it. I was
Did you watch Clerks first?
No, but I've seen Clerks like within the last year. So.
Okay. Did you get the ending then? Did you watch the Marvel ending?
No.
Really?
Okay, I'll have to go back and watch it.
Can I tell you?
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay, so like the ending, they're back at the store.
Oh, no. I did see this. Because what's his name? Are you saying because the dude walks up and checks the lock and it's gum in the lock, and then he says,
he's like, we've been putting gum in those locks for the last 20 years. And that's like the first thing in Clerks is like, some asshole put gum in the locks. Who would do that?
That's hysterical. Okay, yeah, I did see that. I didn't know. I was assuming you meant like there was a post credit scene.
Yeah, that was, right? Wasn't it?
Oh, well, I guess the version that is on Amazon.
Oh, maybe is, not. Yeah, I saw it in theaters.
They moved that scene to be right like tail end of the movie.
Oh, and then really?
The credits happen. Yeah.
No, yeah, well, I saw it for like the road show. It was like one of the, I've never done this before, but it was like a Fathom event, which I would definitely recommend. I've never tried that before. And there's like little extras and stuff, so it's a little more expensive, but you're getting more than just the movie.
Yeah.
And there was like a 20-minute intro with Kevin Smith and Jason Mewes. Oh, and wow. they were telling us all to stay till the end of the credits for a little Marvel thing. Mm. And they're like, we did it this way as kind of a tribute to Stan Lee, I guess. I really call it the Ferris Bueller ending, but we could call it the Marvel ending if you want.
That's hilarious. Yeah, so, but no, I really liked it. I thought that it was, I mean, we can all agree, or I don't know about you, but I feel like a general agreement that Chasing Amy is like his best, most seriously taken movie. It's like a really creative and original idea, and it's a drama, but it's a comedy, and then it got like award recognition.
It's not my favorite, but yeah, I could definitely agree with, you know, the accolades, and it's not that I don't like it.
Yeah.
I just like Clerks the best.
Yeah. Well, Clerks, yeah, Clerks put him on the map. But what I'm saying is, I do think that this one is showing a lot of maturity and ultimately, like, this ultimate understanding for script, like, for format and how movies play out and how the Hollywood system works. It's like, so it's he took, obviously, because it's Jay and Silent Bob reboot, he took Strikes Back and totally did it again, but like really fucking injected steroids into it.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, and watching Kevin Smith Glenn Ross.
Yes, like, yes. Put that pitchfork down.
I'll tell you who. Mitch and Murray, that's who.
Who the fuck are Mitch and Murray? That was hysterical. And I like that too, because the only reason that Silent Bob would talk is to do a movie quote, of course.
A monologue from Glenn. Monologue.
Pitchforks are for Klansmen only. Yeah, that was great. So, but no, I did see that, and I thought that was really fascinating. Because I told you that I just, out of the few little scenes I've seen, I was like, I don't want to, I'm not jazzed about it. I don't think it's going to be good. And I thought it was going to be really corny. But, and it was corny, but it was justifiably corny, because he set the rules for the world pretty early on, saying, you know, when he had Jason Lee explain, basically, what's his name? Banky? Explain, Banky, like, yeah, the world of reboots and how it all works, and then they all like look at the camera, and you know,
what was the one movie he explained that was like so dead on? Oh man,
was it the Star Wars one?
Oh yeah, he's like, I mean, that was like, solid. Star Wars, nope, it's The Force Awakens.
He's like, for example, you know, explain a, what is it, like a couple of droids have plans to a giant death ray in space that's going to blow up a planet, or and the good guys have to go into a trench battle to, you know, blow it up. Or he's like, nope, Force Awakens. Yeah, that's pretty spot on. But yeah, I thought
that really movie impressed. Was like the dream. Like, some people might say the award-winning one, like Chasing Amy in his case, would be the dream, but I'm like, man, that's the dream. Like, making a living, having all your friends and family in a movie, and being something you can be proud of, that I'm like, oh, yeah, man, that's like, that is the peak, man. That's like the best.
Well, I think that it's different for different people. Like, I can tell and totally, you know, level with, it seems like Kevin Smith is a guy who is a fanboy of the industry and of nerd culture. So that is his dream, you know. But there's a lot of people that don't, that, like, I'm kind of falling into a camp that, as I'm living here and being around this industry, I kind of, it's like I roll my eyes at a lot of it, but I do still have that addiction, that want, the drive to make, like, movies. Like, I want to tell stories with the visual medium, but I kind of want to have nothing to do with the industry. You know what I mean?
I just want
to be beside it.
I think everybody is just like a different artist. It's like a museum is what Netflix is, you know, Rogues Gallery is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just a museum with a bunch of different paintings, and you're going to like some and you're not going to like the rest.
Yeah.
And everybody that has like some sort of opinion for how it should be, you know, I mean, maybe they have some points, but frankly, it's like, there's just so many assholes out there. Like, okay, you didn't like it, you didn't have to watch it. Watch one that you like.
Yeah.
Like, there's something for you. It doesn't make Kevin Smith a hack, you know, if you don't like his particular art.
Exactly. It's a different flavor of ice cream, dude.
Yep.
Yeah, you don't need to dog on your friend for getting, you know, butterscotch or whatever. Like, I like mint.
Praline. Ugh.
Praline, yeah. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I think it warrants a second watching, actually, because I was talking to my friend Sean about it. There's so much embedded in every line of dialogue. It's like there's so many jokes here that
and like, he got his friend Ben Affleck like back after that the whole Batman thing and
and their hug crazy. Their hug scene was like kind of a real hug. That was kind of the point, you know.
There was a little Argo joke in there. Oh, and his girlfriend too. What's his name? Joy. What the fuck is her?
Jeff or Ben Amy. Affleck's girlfriend?
Or not Amy, but from Chasing Amy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She was in there playing.
Well,
her
that was Kevin Smith's girlfriend. That's why she was in Mallrats.
Really?
What is her name? Joy dating? Lauren Adams? Is that her name?
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it, like, I went to see him at the Tempe Improv, and it was funny, like, somebody brought up his relationship, and he's like, do you think, like, you know, that relationship, like, tanked, because, and, like, basically, it was because he thought she was cheating, and it was to the point where she actually did cheat on him, because, like, he kept accusing her, and, like, that's where the downfall was, and, like, Kevin Smith, like, he takes, like, a breath to, like, answer, and he's like, first of all, fuck you, and then okay, I'll go ahead and answer since you asked.
Yeah, ouch, dang.
But it was
you were there for that.
Yeah, it was fun. Well, wasn't like being he didn't really mean it like a real F you, but like it was just such a personal question. He was like, okay, this is what you want to talk about?
Crazy.
Somebody like there was a bunch of people that were like, and he pivots like so well. This one guy was like, will you acknowledge that there was a napkin in Tusk that was in one scene and then not there in another scene. And he's like, I think if you watch closely, it's just like a different position of the camera. Like, I'm a real stickler for those kind of things. And we shot all that on the same day. So I really don't think like we would just move a napkin.
Yeah. But why does, at the end of the day, why does it matter?
As if that like had any plot point whatsoever. Like,
yeah. That's hilarious. But yeah, no, I just wanted to say I was pleasantly surprised and you know, let the audience know, because I do remember at one point we did talk about it, and I was, for the most part, I was trashing on it. I was like, you know, it's going to suck and it's going to be corny. And I totally talked about Kevin Smith post pot, like the fact that he's a pothead now. It made his writing weaker, and I'm totally wrong about that. His writing is much stronger now. But we need to understand that Kevin Smith is a mirror con artist. Like, he likes to break the fourth wall. He likes to make fun of himself and his own viewisk universe. That is the way he writes.
Well, everything regarding that is in his book, Tough Shit, and I read this and I was like, man, this is like the best biography ever, as far as any insight into this guy. And he's like, you know, I lost it with Zach and Miri Make a Porno and Cop Out. He's like, I realized that these were movies that I didn't have anything to say, and like the Clerks guy is just not around anymore because I'm not that broke clerk anymore. And then because he has a daughter now and he's made this pivot, and he's making one-off episodes of Supergirl and Arrow and Flash and stuff. Maybe not Arrow. But like, these are the things like he has to say and that he can work on. And so like that, he needed to make that shift. He was going to quit making movies for the longest time.
Yeah. So I do want to close out this episode with another piece of takeaway for the audience. I found this video, and it kind of fell in my lap, so to speak. You know how on YouTube has recommended section?
Missionary Impossible?
Missionary Impossible. Exactly. No, YouTube recommends videos sometimes, and I mean, it's not far out from what I normally watch, but it was really cool. I'm going to it so I can reference the guy, the person who made it. The channel is called Channel Awesome. I guess it's a pretty big channel, 1.2 million subs.
Damn.
But it's called Rating Indie's Lost Character Arc. And what they do, and I'm going to put this in the description of this video. I have this already saved and ready, so I won't forget to put the link so you guys can watch it. But what he does is he takes the entire Indiana Jones like trilogy plus a little bit of involving Crystal Skull, but mostly it's mostly about the original trilogy, and he moves the pieces around in chronological order and kind of in 22 minutes explains the character arc of Indiana Jones, and it's incredibly beautiful. And you and I are, and a lot of people are huge fans of Indiana Jones, but you usually see it for its surface value in the order the movies came out and as individual islands. Each movie is an individual island. But the way he like put it together and play it, explained the whole arc of Indy from the point of being a kid in Utah to his ultimate destiny, which was getting the Grail and recovering his relationship with his father. It's like all one big story. It's really fucking cool.
Yeah. You know, when that Crystal Skull movie came out, like so many people were talking about how they didn't like Indy. I was like, I don't think Indy was the problem with that last movie. I think it was everything else. Like, and I was actually talking about that because I'm like, he went from being the son to being the father. Like, that's a good pivot for the mm-hmm. second movie or the next movie, the last movie, the fourth movie. Whatever it was, but it was the fucking CGI monkeys and Shia LaBeouf's like shitty fucking acting. I don't know that they needed to do a fan service with the girl from the first movie. It was like those things that were like, this is not Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I think you should watch this video because he was right also in saying that the ideas and the script for Crystal Skull is great. It totally plays into the ultimate arc of Indy becoming, like you said, becoming the father after he finally reconciled with his own father and stuff like that.
Send me the link because that sounds good.
And then Mirian is they show like all the other love interests of the show of his arc mm-hmm. were examples of what he shouldn't be or what he, you know, tries not to be or tries hard to be, but he's not his own. It's not I don't know, like I'm butchering it, but Mirian, the reason why he got back together with her is because she was his girl. You know what I mean? Like,
That's the only girl that he picture. Banged and lived too, so
that's true. Yeah,
the second girl was Steven Spielberg's girl, and he wasn't gonna let him have a sex scene with her. And the third girl died. She died at the temple. So what kind of narrows it down? Whatever. I don't know if the young Indiana Jones thing is canon or not, but whatever.
No, they don't mention that the gaps between because those weren't written think those count as canon because they weren't written by the same writers.
I guess there is an episode somewhere I've read about this. I believe it's true. I cannot find it anywhere, but there is an episode that Harrison Ford did of Young Indiana Jones where he plays like a narrator to an episode and he has like a beard and shit. And it was like a one-off episode. And I'm like, man, where the fuck is this thing? It's I've read it on multiple sources and it's just like one cool episode that he did out of the blue. And it was part of the Young Indiana Jones series. And he just happened to work right in there and it was like a flashback kind of episode.
Interesting.
But then I was like, that kind of does make it canon, though, doesn't it? Because it has the real Indiana Jones.
No, Carrie Fisher was in, and Luke and Mark Hamill were in the Star Wars Christmas special. That doesn't make that canon.
Why wouldn't that be canon?
I don't know. I just... here's why I would say Young Indiana Jones isn't canon, is the trajectory of Indiana Jones was set in stone by some writers, by a very specific set of writers. I can't remember their everyone. It, I mean, obviously, George Lucas had a big part in it, but there was a couple other writers involved. Let me see. Who the fuck wrote it? Indiana Jones.
I think David Koepp wrote the fourth one.
Fourth one?
Yeah, Crystal Skull.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about Kasdan.
Lawrence Kasdan. Yeah. Did you know that that his son, I can't remember his first name, but there's also a Kasdan that did School of Rock and the new Jumanji movies.
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not know that.
Isn't that crazy? You're like making Jumanji. I'm like, what? My dad made Star Wars. Anyway, well, Jumanji 3, people, let's go.
Point is, let's just assume it was Kasdan's overall arcing vision of for a character, because he's a great writer. So one would assume that when he's hired to do the sequels, you know, he thinks about how do we continue the arc of this character, and not just individually, because each film has its own arc, but the series itself, he's growing as a person. Mm-hmm. So to take that and then have a completely other set of for lack, you know, for like of more amateur writers, I would assume, writing young Indiana Jones, that doesn't count as canon, because you're probably throwing in all these life lessons and things that we don't, it doesn't tie into the original trilogy. It just like makes, I would think so. I've seen maybe like a handful of young Indiana Jones, young Indy, but I don't know. All I'm saying is this video is really fascinating, and it gives me a whole new respect for the Indiana Jones trilogy.
Is the ride canon? That's what I want. Yes.
The ride has cannons.
Oh.
All right. What do you think we should talk about next time? Do you have any ideas?
Let's see. Since everything is pushed out, and I mean, damn, Quiet Place was supposed to come out. They caught that and moved it at the last minute. But there's The Hunt. I saw Invisible Man. There is Emma. And I think there's a Kumail Nanjiani movie that's going to Netflix. Just like so many things like coming out. And there's a bidding war for these films because they can't push them out, you know, too far, and there's only so many slots that they can fill when this virus is over, and we don't know when that will be. And apparently our president has announced that, you know, all precautions should be extended till the end of April now. So, I mean, we have it at least till then, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think we could just talk about these videos on demands and what's available.
Yeah, that's why I chose streaming. Because I feel like a lot of people are getting into, because we can't, you know, the movie theater, the blockbuster idea isn't really in the forefront of our minds right now. I feel like it's a good time to go into the vault, so to speak, and start doing some episodes about some lost gems that, I mean, you know, just strike your interest, or maybe things that are more topical. But I don't know.
Why don't we talk about films that are only in one place, like bottle episode films? You know what I'm saying?
Not really. Explain.
Like the movie Tape. It's all in one hotel room. Doesn't leave.
Okay.
I guess kind of Hateful Eight would be considered as one of these films. Isolation films. That sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah. Doesn't have to be end of the world, you know, like our last episode. But yeah, that could be timely, and we can expand on that. And it's really hard to make those kind of movies and make them popular because they don't go anywhere. They're all in one. Like, they have to be so captivating or you've completely lost your audience. So,
yep, true. All right, well, sounds like a plan. Next week we're gonna do isolation movies.
That's right.
And all right, well, I guess this concludes our fantastic, wonderful, amazing episode of Flick of the Week.
All right, see you later.
I guess.